So the question has been asked, now that Samba has been perfected by Coverity and has achieved all of its goals and objectives, what will the next version of Samba do? How will we introduce new bugs? Well, the answer is we've invited Microsoft to come and tell us what the next version of Samba will do. And it is my pleasure to introduce Thomas Fenning and Jim Pinkerton. Thomas is local, and Jim has traveled all the way from the United States. He just arrived today, so I'm going to ask you to be very gentle on him. Don't rough him up too much, okay? But just rough him up enough to get out of him everything that you need to know about the next version of Samba. And with no further ado, I'm going to hand over to Thomas Fenning.
Okay. I guess I'm free game then for you to pick on. my name is Thomas Fenning. I'm actually not local, but I'm the. I came here last year after a long time. It's the first time Microsoft representation at Samba XP. And we liked the hospitality, so we thought we'd come back. And my role at Microsoft is I run the team that's responsible for all the remote file system technologies. That's SMB, NFS, whatever sort of has to do with remote file systems is being done in my team. And last year, we didn't have any history, so I thought this year we actually, I give you a quick summary of what we achieved last year, like what is all the points where like Samba team and Microsoft worked together, and how did that work out? And then the agenda looks very similar to what I did last year. So we now publish the protocol documentation, but on your end, from many angles, that's sort of an inverse way of looking at things, because you just see what changes in the protocol, but you don't really know why we did the one thing or the other. So I give you a little bit of the background why we did things, and then that's sort of the fluff part, and then Jim is going to dig into the details and shows you like how that looks like and how it actually performs. So as I mentioned last year, we came here pretty cold, and we got a warm welcome. We appreciate that. So we decided to come back and continue sort of the probably established tradition. And the goal is sort of our development team constantly works on releases. Last year, we were basically talking about what we've done for Vista and Server 2008. As most of you know, we recently released the Windows 7 beta, and there's updates to SMB. And so this time around, I'm going to talk about what we did and what we did for that. We sponsored the SDC, the SNEA System Developer Conference in the US, and from an interop perspective, that was a tremendous success. I mean, see a couple of faces here that came there, and so the amount of interop that was achieved at that event was just tremendous. So we're planning on doing that again this year, so in fall, we're going to again sponsor the SDC and hope that we get many people to come and visit. And then we had a little bit of excitement. So Windows 7 has been in development, and at some point it turned out, well, Samba clients couldn't connect anymore. Question was, well, what was going on? Who was at fault? And I have to say that was a breakthrough experience. Jeremy is smiling, so I take it was a positive experience. And so the sort of the remarkable things about that was there was actually, before that release even hit the market, there was some interop testing done. It was found it broke, but just the fact that sort of people start paying attention to each other and do their testing proactively, that's a great breakthrough. And then two also remarkable events happened. First of all, the Samba team filed some bugs against us. So we had some bugs to fix, and we filed some bugs against the Samba team for the first time on the Techno Reflector. So overall, I think this is like when you think back, we started out showing up here cold. This is a pretty good result. So let's continue working on that. And from our side, we're very open to like any form of interaction. Just to sort of refresh, last year, sort of at the end of the talk, I chatted a little bit about, here's what we're trying to do for Windows 7. And these are all sort of a couple of things from that slide taken directly. And so the biggest thing was documentation. We're sort of still in this process of refining that documentation and making it better. And turns out it's a little bit like an IKEA manual. So IKEA doesn't try to write bad manuals, but if you've ever tried to assemble any of that furniture, you know what I'm talking about. Performance is the other thing. Actually, to some degree with the discussions we had last year here, there were lots of interesting comments about some of the parallelisms and whether they're in the protocol level, whether they're at the application level. And we took some of that stuff and actually made some changes in Windows, not so much on the protocol, to get like a higher level of parallelism. We're going to talk about that. And then the networking world has changed. We have certain applications inside Microsoft where people have gigabit pipes on other continents. That creates interesting challenges because suddenly you end up with these massive bandwidth delay products, and keeping those pipes filled means you have to sort of send out like sometimes like more than 10 megabytes into the ether before you get any acknowledgement. And so we did some tuning to sort of enable that, and we delivered on that. And then the big thing that we actually sort of got beaten up about a lot that I mentioned last time was branch performance. More and more of our customers are either like mobile users on laptops or people in branch offices. With central file servers, we had some serious issues around the performance, just the chattiness of the protocol, but it was just like some mechanical implementation things that were not done very optimally. And so we focused a lot on cutting down on chattiness and sort of giving more like a more local-like experience. So how get you closer to when you open a local file, but you can really have central file servers. And we did a lot of changes there, some around caching, some around the oplock leasing model. So we introduced a completely new leasing model for SMB 2.1, and we talk about why we did that and how it all worked out. One of the other interesting features we did, caching obviously becomes a big, big issue. And for certain types of content, we introduced something you can think of like a BitTorrent for the branch office. And BitTorrent has, of course, its ups and downs. And the trick here was, how do you don't break the security model of SMB? So we think we came up with some model where you basically have a branch cache that sort of maintains all the normal SMB security. Trends, if you think about sort of what we've been trying to do, we're still sort of pummeled by sort of this trend that people just don't sit at their desks anymore. Most people don't have desks anymore. They all roam around, and either they roam around in the same building, but everyone has a laptop. And even at Microsoft, more and more of these computers are no longer connected via at wire speed. It's all wireless. So the connections become transient. You go around the corner. These networks like are in and out. And we still saw quite a bit of issues with the way SMB behaved in those environments. So we refined what we put up with the durable handles, and we have some additional stuff we did there in order to make sure that the experience gets better. Another thing that hit us pretty badly is server consolidation. Just give you like some one data point. We had customers that had like 1,000 Windows file servers, and they replaced them by like 15 other boxes. Just being able to consolidate and build much, much larger scale file servers at very large scale. So there's petabyte file servers, single namespace. Well, our stuff doesn't really work well there. And so we're thinking about how can we basically get to a model where we can scale up. And so we did some small steps now, and we're going to take some more steps in the next release. Mobile workers and WAN accelerators. And WAN accelerators have become really sophisticated. So it used to be sort of a little bit of compression. Now it's like very, very large caches and very, very sophisticated compression technologies. At some point, they're now talking about doing compression at rest. What about if you basically compress, sort of ties in with deduplication? So if you can dedupe the files, maybe you can just like transfer the deduped stuff and you can save a lot of bandwidth. So that whole story is still evolving and it's moving very, very fast. Reason is the return of investment, it's simple. Like these companies have like sheets out there and they can, within 6 months, you get return of investment and you can save a lot of money. So clearly an area where we tried to do something and we're still investing. stuff that is sort of picking up speed fast, virtualization. Trend is now sort of the IDC just released a couple of studies, and they're predicting that by 2015, about 60-70% of all servers will be virtualized. That's only a few years. If everything is going to be virtualized, what does it mean for our storage? And so, well, we got sort of the end user and home directories, that's one workload, but it turns out, well, there might be other workloads. In Windows 7, one of the more interesting features is you can go to disk management and you can create basically VHD files as local drives. Well, it turns out these VHD files can be local, but they can also be remote. Well, that remote protocol turns out to be SMB. Well, what are the requirements onto SMB to reliably emulate a remote drive? Those are very different requirements than what an end user have if they're using Word. And so we're trying to understand that better to have like a low-cost option for these virtualized environments. And power friendliness, power, 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 all the data centers are full, and the real limitation is just how much power can you squeeze into that physical space. There's no more cooling to be had, and there's virtually no more power to be had. And so how can we make sure that our protocol and our implementation adapts itself better to like these pressures? At Microsoft, turns out all the internal file servers at Microsoft are scheduled to be virtualized by the end of the year. And so there's no more file server on real hardware. And the reason for that is, well, there's no more machines to be had. So the only new machines and the only deployments you can get is all virtual. So that's clearly something we need to pay a lot of attention to. Looking in sort of what were sort of the biggest drivers that helped us with the WAN and branch experience. We still were pretty chatty. And one of the things you can do to reduce chattiness is obviously you can do caching. Caching always helps. And we had some levels of caching in the previous release. And this time around, we've put a lot more sort of detailed work to it in terms of making the caches dynamically size. So we start with some standard values, then they can grow up dynamically, and then they scale back, so you actually don't lock up all the memory. But that gives you quite some nice savings. One issue that we knew about for many years, but we're not able to do much about, had to do with the way oplogs work. And turns out, and all of you everyone who sort of works on oplog and Samba is probably aware, that many of our applications, they open file handles, multiple file handles from the same application, and break their own oplogs, which means you have to throw away the caching, and the read caching goes south. And so we thought about a model how to make sure we can avoid that without going back to the application developers and tell them to fix all their applications. And yeah, you laugh, but that's reality, right? There's a lot of people to talk to. And so Jim is going to give you a pretty detailed description of how that works and how effective it actually is. It's quite stunning, like even like for standard Word, what you see. We talked about the last time we were here, we had like these interesting discussions with Jeremy and with Tridge about, well, how do you sort of do parallelism? And is that an SMB v1 thing? Is that an SMB v2 thing? And in Windows, a lot of it is actually driven by some of the system APIs. So we got this copy file API that almost anyone is using if they want to move files. And so in order to drive more parallelism out of the protocol, we made some changes to copy file and then even to the applications. So the number one application that people use to copy around files is RoboCopy. Well, if RoboCopy is written in a way that you copy one file at a time, you can do anything to the protocol, it's not going to do much. So that got all fixed. That is not protocol related, but in terms of like the observed speed that an end user will see, that makes a big difference. And when these things hit the Samba server, you will want to optimize for like what we did there. We had some interesting little issues. Win32 or NTFS like had some. All of the above.
Okay.
It's all of the above. What was really bad was like copying a large number of small files was just a disaster, and so that's taken care of. And then the multiple read requests and much larger. The whole crediting algorithm got fixed, so we can actually send out a lot more data in parallel.
Did you have any problems with hitting the max MUX?
The max MUX?
Maximum out of simultaneous requests on the wire at the same time. And the next project by, let's take that
later. We spent months, and Jim can give you the detail, of optimizing some of our applications. We have there's a funny thing about tax laws in the US. If you finish your product, finished by some definition, in Puerto Rico, you get a big tax break. Well, what does it mean to finish software? It turns out, like, the legal definition, what's good enough is if you sign it. So if the encryption key that is added, so when you had the license, you do that in Puerto Rico, that basically finishing the product means. So everything that Microsoft does is now being sent to Puerto Rico for signing. And, they wanted to use SMB, and we had some interesting learnings from that because it's terabytes, and so it's good experience. Yeah, it's funny things. So it's we had the sort of one of the features of Windows 7 that is using SMB is this technology with clustered shared volumes, which is sort of a clustered file system that's sitting behind Hyper-V. And that's using SMB for all the metadata operations. It's using like direct fiber channel connections for the I/O, but it's using SMB for all the metadata. And turns out there were some interesting issues there when you have to open multiple handles in order to get write-through mode. And so one of the extensions where we offered that you can select a flag that existed in NTFS but was never passed over SMB is now available in SMB as well. And so for applications that take advantage of it, databases and stuff, you will have to do that as well. Same development strain is some operations can take a very long time. 60 seconds timeout for async operations. We found cases where that didn't work. So now the server can give hints that if the server knows up front that the operation will take a very, very long time to complete, it can send hints so that you can avoid the timeouts. And we basically had like large SAN arrays, but when you do extending writes, then those writes can sometimes like result in very, very long delays. And for these large Hyper-V clusters under high load, that made a big difference. What else do we have here? The directory cache we talked about. Good. So these are sort of the high-level things. And with that, we're going to spend significant time drilling really, really deep into some of the details of this. And I leave it to Jim to start with the new uplock model.
Thank you, Thomas. I'll go ahead and go with the mic. It's been an interesting year. In the last year, I think one of the things that's been really great in the interaction we've seen with you guys and also in terms of looking at the blogs is it's helped us a lot in terms of being more intellectually honest in terms of creating a dividing line between what is an implementation issue versus what is a protocol issue. Mm-hmm. For instance, I noticed in my prior slide that I screwed up and put improved copy file under SMB 2.1 and it was intended to be under Windows 7 implementation issues. Clearly that's not a protocol issue. So I'm continuing to evolve. but one of the things that I've seen in the blogs, for instance, is an ongoing controversy about SMB 1 versus SMB 2 and some of the contrasting that we've done in that area. And I think going forward, hopefully, we'll be a little bit more intellectually honest about that. And very much appreciate feedback in this talk or offline to make sure that we start drawing a better line in terms of what is a protocol issue versus what is an implementation issue and try to cleanly separate that so that we can discuss then in terms of the SAMBLA implementation what portions of our local heuristics are appropriate to put into other operating systems and what portions aren't versus what portions are protocol specific and are actually required for interop. When we look at the current bottlenecks that we've seen in SMB and SMB2 specifically, what we found is that, particularly in the branch environment, the chattiness that we have traditionally exhibited has been a killer. And as we talked about last year, it's created SMB/SIFS is essentially the poster child for the WAN acceleration market, And that's a little depressing. You'd like to be able to not create a multi-billion dollar business off of your screw-ups. But I think we can do better. And when you start looking at what it takes to move the app community forward in a binary compatible way, maintaining the semantics that they're used to while also directly attacking the chattiness, it gets a little complex. There's a lot of trade-offs in terms of how you can potentially change wire behavior. Specifically for us, what we found when we started really looking at the chattiness is that a lot of common apps, for instance, Office, actually breaks its own op lock. Commonly. Every time you open a Word document, you break your own op lock. Because the world has moved on from the op lock definitions that were created back in the 90s, and today what is commonly done is they have a library. And the library, you know, all these high-level object-oriented things that opens handles like candy with all sorts of different access permissions, will break its own op lock. And so therefore, all of the wonderful client caching that was intended to be enabled in the client is now broken, and it all flows on the wire straight across. And so what we found then is that these op lock breaks were not atypical. In fact, they were completely common when you go off and look at what is going on in the real world. Just to provide a brief background on op locks for the probably two or three people in the audience that don't know what they are, the traditional model for op locks is we had three levels. We had exclusive, batch, and level two. And the intent then was to be able to fall back to various levels through an op lock break if it turns out that the various opens that were to that file were not compatible with your current level of op lock. And so the best level of op lock would allow you to be able to cache reads, writes, and your handles. So you could do delayed closes. If you weren't able to always do that, you can fall back to exclusive and then potentially fall all the way back to level two where you can at least cache reads, although you can't cache handles. You can't delay your closes. And then, of course, if anything happens either from the same client or from a different client, we would potentially then break that op lock and cause everything to flow to the server to ensure that file consistency is guaranteed. So this was, and I apologize for the people in the back row. We'll definitely make the slides available afterwards. Feel free to move forward because this is the first of many slides with lots of really ugly, gory little details that to me are important. And you may not be able to read them all the way in the back. But in any case, to me, the common case that was intended, the current design was intended to solve, is this one, where you're able to have potentially multiple opens. They all have the same access modes, read-write, for instance, in this case. So you're able to collapse the first open into the handle that's associated with the second open and back into the first open, and the third open back into the first open. And you're able to then cache your reads. You're able to cache your writes. And you're able to delay closes, so you only flow one close. That's if the stars align, which honestly they haven't for a while. What we're really seeing is if you go through sequential opens, for instance, here the application does an open, does a read followed by a close, the read is cached. And normally what we try to do is delay the close so that you can maintain the cache. However, here the second open is in with different access rights. Therefore, it won't collapse. Therefore, we have to flow the close. We have to invalidate the cache. We then create another open. And then for us, where we actually buffer on page boundaries, if you're in buffered mode, we'll actually read the data again. If, for instance, the first thing you do is a write, and then potentially cache the write on the client, and then close, and then, of course, as part of the close, flow the write to the server. So this is one source of chattiness. Another source that's actually even worse is when you have parallel open handles. It's not sequential, it's all at the same time. And now we're seeing op lock breaks going back and forth due to the parallel opens. So we have here, as a very simple example, H1 and H2 opens, again, different access modes. So they don't collapse. So we see an op lock break that comes back to be able to, that must be completed before the other open can complete. the write can no longer be cached. It should have been cached against the read potentially. And then, of course, the closes have to be flowed as well. So all of this ends up resulting in a lot of chattiness. So what we wanted to be able to do is take this now common mode, and again, after going out and talking to some of the apps, you know, having them change their behavior isn't exactly an easy thing to do in this day and age, nor even really a desirable thing, because customers tend to be very slow about upgrading their apps. And so it's much better to take the world as it is in many situations and then try to work optimally within it. So this caused us to go down the path of a new model of an op-lock that we call leasing. So leasing is really a fundamentally different mode for how op-locks are handled, designed to first address the issues that I just outlined in the prior slides. And then the other issue is we'd actually, if we have to fall all the way back to just read caching, we'd like to be able to cache the read handle as well, so that we can do the delayed close optimizations there. The other side that we're seeing is some middleware libraries actually have multiple processes, so we can't just potentially collapse it around a process ID. So we went to a key that the client can maintain. So this allows us to be able to collapse all of the caching across all processes on the client rather than just to a single process. And then the other side is, you would potentially need to be able to upgrade the lease from, say, a read lease to a read handle release or a read write handle lease. So this then creates the new semantics that are outlined in the SMB 2.1 protocol documentation. It's probably worthwhile to note that this high-level stuff here goes through a bit of the rationale, which, as Thomas pointed out, we tend to not be real good at doing in our protocol documentation. It's more, what does the protocol do, rather than why did we do it? But all of this is available on the web, and I strongly encourage you to download that. And then the other side is the Netmon Protocol Analyzer, version 3.3, has been upgraded to support SMB 2.1, so you get all the nice pretty print of the protocol. And it will also deal with the compounding issue. So when you have multiple SMB requests in the same packet, it'll properly decode that as well. So it's really the combination of those two things that hopefully provide the meat. And this at least provides a little bit of the background. So the design goal then is that we effectively optimize for these four cases, where we have read caching. These three effectively map to the existing mechanisms, and then we have a brand new mechanism so we can, instead of the level 2 op lock, we can now cache reads as well as the handle. As I previously talked about, then we have this key that's a lease key. The lease key is generated by the client. It's handed to the server. The server then tracks that by a concatenation of the lease key and the client GUID. From there, then the normal mechanisms, if a separate client, for instance, comes in, or the same client with a different lease key comes in, you can still have the op-lock break that we're all very familiar with to be able to fall back to something that's compatible. And so in terms of how you can change that lease state, the client can then ask for an upgrade of the lease state. For instance, it asked originally for caching of reads and handle, and say there was a new open that came in that needed to be able to cache writes. It can then, in that open, ask for an upgrade of the current lease key. We do not support downgrades in the protocol. And then, of course, if the server wishes, due to potentially conflicting open, server can always downgrade through the op-lock break mechanism.
Jim?
Sorry, go ahead.
When you say that the client can upgrade an op-lock, lease.
Yeah. Right, and so. Server actually moderates that issue, so the client will ask for something, but it won't necessarily be granted it.
Yeah, but I mean, is there something like, okay, tell me when I get the op lock?
No.
You try, and then you know.
Okay,
right. well, you can certainly implement whatever algorithm you want. what we tend to do is take what we get. And yeah, the worst case is you get no op-lock, and you flow everything.
But this means so when the situation changes on the startup,
right.
So that I could get an op-lock,
right.
I'm not told.
Exactly. That is fair. That is true. Well, that edge case is not covered.
I think, just to be clear, sort of, we don't expect the client application to actually change. So what we did a lot of tracing to make sure that the common applications that create most of that noisy traffic today will just work in this model. Okay. Does it make sense?
The other side is it actually comes back to the kind of workload that we're focusing on. A lot of these kind of conflicts, from my side, come into what I've been commonly calling the home directory workload. And so that particular use case is not common of that, so we did not optimize for it. And it introduces a lot of funky race conditions when you go down the path of having notifications.
Want to fix the self-likes only in this step.
Right.
Okay. Yeah.
Jeremy?
Is requesting an upgrade a synchronization point? So in other words, if you request an upgrade, let's say a server implementation says, damn, I can't do that now, but you know, I might be able to do that in a little while, will the client refuse to do anything on those handles while that pending request for upgrade is outstanding, or will it continue to do access on the current handle it has, on the current level it has?
Same thing.
So, in other words, could you do it by delaying the reply to the lease upgrade?
So, the lease is granted as part of the create. And so you're not able to operate on the handle until you get the completion of the open, of the create.
So what about an upgrade?
Pardon?
What about an upgrade? You're saying that you can now upgrade over the handle.
Right. So the upgrade is done as part of the open, as part of the create. You specify the same lease key.
Oh, okay. So you
can handle
it. Correct.
Right. Exactly.
I don't think there are many applications sort of that are trying to game the system at this point. It's just like you do an open and then...
Right. I mean, there is potentially flexibility going down that path through the op-lock break mechanism because the server can actually specifies the new level. Currently, what we do is only downgrade. We haven't really seen a whole lot of need for the other side, but happy to talk about it offline.
What would you do if the server gave you an
upgrade? That's a good question.
Yeah.
The fun and games of interop, right? And so then, mapping that to one very real-world case, Office 2007, specifically Word opening of a doc or a docx file, you end up with pretty substantial differences. I'm going to skim through this fairly quickly. This shows that there's a .doc file versus a .docx file. We actually have two different modes. The file format itself doesn't really matter. What actually matters is Office figures out, based on the extension, what mode it uses to access the file. If it's a .docx, it's basically a copy file to bring the file locally. If it's not, then it actually has quite a bit more chattiness. So if you see on the bottom, you see roughly 31% reduction in the frame rate for the .doc version. And then for the .docx, where it's essentially a copy file, it's still approximately 17% reduction. In this table, it also talks a little bit to the full traffic on the wire. This set of operations here really has nothing to do with the new leasing model. It has everything to do with the caching optimizations around metadata operations that Thomas had alluded to.
And so the PDU size might sound small, but this is all serialized stuff, so it's a huge impact on slow links. It's just massive.
Yep. I'm gonna switch gears to the other feature that Thomas alluded to, what we're calling the distributed / hosted cache model. In this mode, we actually do not potentially download the content. We'll still flow the open to the server, but the actual content could be potentially accessed from a peer in the branch, thus making your bandwidth potentially radically. Bandwidth requirements potentially radically better in terms of WAN utilization and also end user wait time. The amount of time it takes to open a file can be radically better depending upon the speed of the link. There's really two different modes here. One is what we call distributed cache. The other is what we call a hosted cache. Distributed cache is a true peer-to-peer in the branch where you potentially have, say, 100 clients that you can access their content from in a secure way. The thing that's nice about this architecture is it is not a man-in-the-middle architecture, so it does preserve end-to-end encryption, end-to-end signing, specifically SMB signing, and potentially IPsec. This library is and set of protocols is actually independent of SMB. We're simply using this capability. The protocols are defined in the normal location off of Microsoft.com. There's four different protocols involved, and in a couple slides I'll walk through the results. Due to time constraints, I'm not going to be able to really nail the following slides as well as I'd hoped, but what the heck, we can talk about it offline or over lunch. The basic idea at a very high level is you have some file server in the main office with a branch office that's got a few clients. Normal SMB access would do a GET of the file. This is kind of viewed as generic because this actually applies to either HTTP or SMB. In any case, there's a set of data up there with some hashes that are associated with that data. We then download the hash list. We then advertise to the local branch to see if anybody has that hash list. In this case, they don't, so we'll then download the data. Aren't these great little marketing slides? In any case, for the second access from the client, from the branch, from a different client, they again flow and open, download the hash list, advertise to see if anybody has that content, and then potentially retrieve it from the peer in the branch. And this same kind of a model then works for a hosted cache where you have a single common server in the branch as well, so you don't necessarily have to go peer-to-peer if you don't want to deploy it that way. The basic idea is you have some content that you need to be able to hash against. We subdivide that content into segments. Today, those are 64K. We then subdivide that into blocks.
64K,
segments.
64K or larger, they can grow up quite large.
Yes.
Depending on the size of the file.
So the segments are actually used for trying to figure out who has content in the branch. And then after you find out who has content in the branch, then you can, on a per block boundary, retrieve stuff much smaller than that. And then, of course, the hash list is simply the concatenation of the segment hashes and the block hashes, plus a private key. In terms of the security model, of course, it's important that the content that's being handed back and forth in the branch is only accessed in a secure fashion. The content between peers is always encrypted. There are three pre-configured keys. You have an encryption key, a segment discovery key, and on the server side, you have a server secret key. And then when you look at, again, I'm having to whip through this a bit to stay on schedule here, what is actually handed down in that hash list that I talked about in the prior slide is the block hashes, the segment hashes, and then a private segment key to ensure that people can only access segments that they have permission for. These next two slides walk through in some detail what that pretty little chart did two slides ago. I'm going to skip over it to some degree. It is probably worthwhile to note, so it is a broadcast-based mechanism in the branch to be able to find out who it is that has the segments. Then the peer replies with what segments that they contain. They always have a segment key to ensure that all of the data is encrypted. After they then respond, potentially from multiple clients, with who has what segments, then the client that is trying to retrieve the content then goes out potentially doing parallel requests to all of the clients that reply, then accessing the particular blocks. Once it actually pulls the data back in, it has a hash, a SHA-256 hash on a per block basis, that it runs against the actual data retrieved to make sure that somebody isn't gaming the system. And then assuming that the data integrity check is shown to be valid, It then returns that to the application. Yes?
And all this is available for Win32 apps doing create file, read file, write file.
Correct.
So implementing the Win7 kernel.
Yes.
Impressive.
We've had a fun time.
And it not just works on SMB, it works for HTTP as well.
Yes. I'm going to move along. Apologies. Some data. Two separate sets of data. One is wait time. How long does the end user have to sit there on their butt waiting for this file to be downloaded? For this case, the design goal was to look at one megabit per second WAN. So this is the real, you know, low-end branch office that that we're seeing very broadly deployed using 100 millisecond latencies. So you can see here, and apologies to the folks in the back again, there's four different cases shown here. Vista going to Win2K8. Second case is Windows 7 cold cache, meaning there's no cache in the client. Third case is a Windows 7 client who has accessed it on that specific client before, so it's in the local disk, so you're not actually going over the network to the peers to retrieve the data. And then the fourth case then is when it's a warm cache somewhere in the network, but it's not local. And so you can see the actual wait time can be substantially reduced if you've got that cache live. Offline, I'd be happy to walk you through the data a little bit more. This shows you the bandwidth savings in terms of the WAN link. You can see it's really quite surprisingly large. What is kind of interesting to note is that it's not zero data transfer. Keep in mind that for this set of data, we're always downloading the hash. So for very small files, you actually have a little bit more data being downloaded. If you've got, say, a one byte file, the hash list would actually be potentially longer than the length of the file. One byte files aren't very common anymore. What we actually do is prefetch 64K from the server to make sure that the end user has some amount of responsiveness, and thus the data transfer does not go to zero in all cases. For the case of XCopy specifically, it does. We have some other changes Thomas kind of alluded to. I'm not going to go into a whole lot at this stage. I don't have the gory data yet. We are planning on presenting the gory data at SNIA SDC, assuming that our talk proposal is accepted.
Pretty likely.
I hope. The large MTU support is something we actually chatted quite a bit about last time. And so I won't go into it in any great detail. The other side that we found is FU is quite common when you look at local operations, and being able to preserve that when you go across the network helps in terms of app compat. And then we have this new form of variable handles called resilient handles, where we've defined a new FSCTL to be able to allow the client to deterministically get that durable handle. So we had to rename it. We call it resilient handles.
And why we don't have like the actual detailed data, we're going to do that at SNIA. I just want to sort of give you a glimpse sort of on the large MTU support on 10 gigabit Ethernet interfaces, bring multiple, and we run at line speed.
We've got some changes in terms of our client behavior. The interim response issue has been asked for by several different folks. We've also seen it in terms of particularly applications that do extending writes, where, for example, they're writing 64 megabytes beyond into file, and that can cause, at least in NTFS, a zeroing of all the bytes in between. That can take a very long time, and potentially under extreme heavy load conditions, cause a serious issue, a disconnect, a timeout on the operation, which causes a disconnect. And since the server knows, or presumably knows, what it can do quickly and what it can't, what we've changed is if you're doing an asynchronous operation and you hand back the interim response, then we automatically change the timeout of that specific operation from 60 seconds to 240 seconds. We also have spent quite a bit of time going down multi-threading path, have an amazingly rich set of 120 unique test cases that we run both in terms of local, remote, remote to local, local to remote, remote to more remote. We spent a lot of time looking at a particular utility we call RoboCopy. That's a shell command going up to potentially hundreds of threads working in parallel. This helps radically in terms of small file transfers. In terms of large file transfers, we also support, of course, asynchronous operations. And so we can fill the pipe right quite nicely if you have a very large file you're transferring. That was the talk that we did a year ago. Where this really makes an astonishing difference is when you have lots and lots of small files or a mix of small files and large files. And again, we'll be presenting that hopefully at SNEA, SDC in September. A quick spiel for power management. This actually has absolutely nothing to do with SMB 2.1, to me, it's a very important topic. One of the issues that we've seen in the field, and certainly regulatory agencies are now pushing very hard, is they'd like machines to be able to go do what we call idle sleep. If it's doing no work, why not allow it to go to sleep? Previously, we had certain heuristics that would cause us to not go to sleep, which obviously causes a very large difference in power consumption. This walks through, again, due to time constraints, I'm going to kind of skip over this, but I would strongly encourage Samba on both the client side and on the server side to explore these heuristics. I don't think it technically affects interop, but I also think it's a good thing in general for all of us to be much better about power management. And with that, Thomas?
Sure. So this was sort of the rushed through version of what we did for Win 7, and I'd say we had a pretty good year. So we're pretty happy with the stuff we achieved, but the world is not standing still, and so Windows 7 is ramping down. It's basically, we're pretty much done with all the features. Right now we're in stabilization, bug fixing, testing, but there's not anything more that's going to come in Win 7. So we're basically start thinking about where we're going to head next. And one of the topics we talked about last year, and we didn't really get off the ground, is this Unix interop thing. I mean, you guys did all the extensions, the Unix extensions for SMB v1, and we really would like to see that happen for SMB v2. We just need to have the time to sit down and define that mechanism. So I'm open to time. We just need to sit down and get it done. And then we sort of had like cursory things about encryption and compression. And the encryption thing, I mean, that becomes like more complex by the longer we wait. Of course, you can do it at the IPsec level, you can do it at the tunnel level, and now we got the thing called direct access, which basically all the machines look like IPv6 hosts on the internet. And so at what level do you want to encrypt? So still not clear, we should talk about that. Compression is becoming tricky. One of the big differentiators for file servers these days used to be sort of mostly for tape storage and backup was deduplication. So data at rest is being compressed. Now that becomes a huge differentiating factor for large file server installations. We talked about our caching that only works for the second download. What about the first download? If you need to download a large file, you want to somehow minimize the amount of traffic you transfer on that first download. So is that integrated with dedupe or not? So that's another area I'd be very interested to hear your thoughts on. File area networking is interesting, mostly driven by NFS. So most of you know there's the Federated FS Working Group, which is sort of a DFS clone now being done for NFS. And the worst that could happen is if these two mechanisms are completely incompatible. So we're trying to figure out our strategy there. If you guys have thoughts, I'd be interested to coordinate. Clustering, last year we heard from Tridge about sort of the clustering efforts. I think I mentioned consolidation is one big pressure. People want to consolidate to very, very large file servers. So one of the areas we're going to go after for Windows 8 is figure out some form of clustering. And again, I know that you guys had some learnings. I'm sure you guys will want to follow. So I'd be interested to talk about that. Server workloads. I mentioned this issue with Windows 7 allows you to basically have remote VHD files. So the question is, well, there might be all sorts of application running on those simulated drives, things like SQL. Well, to put it mildly, like SMB right now might not be optimized for a SQL workload. So what are the changes that we will have to do in order to get to the reliability, availability, and responding very, very quickly, reducing the latency to some of those server workloads. So that's going to be a focus for the next release. HPC right now is coming from a relatively small socket, mostly NFS dominated, but it's the fastest growing workload, 160% growth. So if we want to play there with SMB and SIFS, we need to probably look into what are those workloads, what are the characteristics of those workloads. So we're doing some research there, and we'll share that publicly, but it likely is also going to result in some changes to the protocol to cater to that specific audience. All our SMB 2.1 stuff is documented up to the stuff that shipped in beta. We made a few more changes, and the one thing that's not included is resilient handles, and that's an upgrade we did to the durable handles. Again, coming back to that VHD case, so if you have your simulated drive and you lose your connection, that might not be a good experience because that NTFS volume goes away. And today, durable handles rely on you having an op lock, but that VHD process that keeps that remote VHD open knows for sure that it's the only one who has the thing open, and it knows for sure that it wants to get reconnected no matter what else. So we now have basically added an FS control that allows you to demand that you always reconnect to be a little bit more resilient. And so those two things will come out in the next version of that we release. And then Chris Hertel is here somewhere in the room, right there. And I think last year I talked about finding a way how we basically better document SIFs, where sort of three different set of documents existed. None of them were complete. None of them 100% accurate. So SIFs took on the Chris took on the task, I think, for all of us, trying to come up with one definitive version. And he has come a long way. So tomorrow he's going to talk about how far that got and basically launch public access. And then we had to do this file system overview document. And that's also going to be released in the next couple of months. We would like to...
Also, Randy's talk on tomorrow morning,
on the FSSO,
I believe.
Yeah.
On FSSO. Randy, you want to raise your hand?
Randy back there. He's the guy who did the FSSO document. And then we really like to sort of focus this year's SDC onto SMB v2. And so we hope to see a lot of you there. And we also have, of course, our SMB interop events on campus. And the other area that we might be interested to talk to you guys about, like whether you're interested in implementing that key oppression peer caching protocol, because that actually saves a lot of traffic in many, many scenarios.
Is that protocol dependent on the server, or is it like a separate service?
The peer caching?
Yeah.
So the server has to be able to generate the hashes, right? And that, so the server itself does not actually participate in the protocol. It just generates the hash list and then has to implement the FSCTL to allow you to download the hash list. And then it's the peers.
It's two things. It's a,
yes.
It's a share property, exactly. Allow you to discover whether that share supports it, and then it's an FSCTL to download the hashes.
How do you do that when you're using HTTP? You said it's more
closer for HTTP. Let's take that offline, but yeah, it is a bit different. In the details, conceptually, though, it's exactly the same thing. The server supports the ability to download a set of hashes, and if it downloads that set of hashes, then you can go through the peer or hosted cache to be able to retrieve the content. It's all fully spec'd in the protocol spec that I referenced in the prior slide.
In that case, it's still connected to the SMB server?
No, nothing to do.
Yeah.
But sort of like the other big there's sort of two large repositories of documents. One are just file servers, and the other one is SharePoint. So this works for SharePoint as well, because that's using DAV, right?
When do you expect the docs to be updated with the resilient handles?
Next version that goes out. I don't know, when is the next public version going out?
Certainly within the next few months. Honestly, I don't know the exact release schedule, but it is the next few months.
We have a document, so this is pipeline, right? So we document it, then it goes to writers and blah, 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 blah. And so whenever that gets published.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Is there a way to, are there any provisions in the new spec for better handling of that?
We haven't changed that at all in this release.
But if you want to talk about that, because
I would love to talk about
For clustering, right? That's definitely one of the areas.
Clustering or just even general client, you know, where your client's heating a lot.
Sure, but for clustering, it's essential.
Right.
So one of the things we're thinking through, like, what does it have to be for clustering?
And I'd honestly love to hear the use cases as well, because that's part of what I'm grappling in terms of client SKU workloads. What are the use cases that create the lock contention in this specific race that you're talking about?
So we've been wave two, so which I guess it means
the cane is out.
So if you guys have any questions, we will be hanging around, and so happy to talk more.
Well, thank you, gentlemen. I'd like to thank you.